This is the hymn Jerusalem, a song that's been called the unofficial anthem of England. It's also the title of Jez Butterworth's latest play, which opened recently on Broadway. It tells the story of a man who's nothing like the tea and crumpets image that's often associated with England. Johnny Byron goes by the name Rooster, and he throws wild and crazy parties, sells drugs, and makes it his business to annoy the neighbors and the local authorities. But he also loves the place he calls home. Jerusalem is playing at the Music Box Theater on West 45th Street through August 21st. And joining me now is Mark Rylance, who plays Rooster. It gives me great pleasure to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Hi, Leonard.
The song Jerusalem has a long story of its own. Isn't the lyric a rather ironic poem that was written by William Blake in the 19th century?
Yeah, I've acted Blake a long time ago now, but I can't imagine he would take much to the hymn or the way that it's used, or that kind of dreamy sound you hear there where you can't hear the words, because the words are quite, yeah, the words are strong and come from his outrage and horror at what the Industrial Revolution was doing to England, and the idea of, you know, is this really what we who are gifted to live on this island, is this what we should make of it? Or is there a different purpose or fortune for this island?
So how did it come to become this idyllic song that is about singing the praises of England?
Yeah, I don't know, you know. I don't know. I mean, the music.
They teach it
very...
every school kid sings this
song.
Oh,
yeah, and you immediately get pictures of Brideshead Revisited and Jeremy Irons walking through the grass and, you know... Yeah, I don't know how it's come. I suppose it was probably taught in the great grammar schools to boys, and therefore it became a sentimental thing. But the lines, dark satanic mills, are very clear about what Blake feels about industry.
It's often described as a song of hope, but I wonder if you think your character Rooster is hopeful.
Yeah, I think he's very hopeful. I think he's very hopeful in that. I think he really, I think he does really love young people. I think he likes truth in the way that a rooster likes the sun coming up, you know, and as something coming through bright and clear. And I probably have rosy-colored spectacles when I think about him as I'm playing him, but I think that he likes that moment in young people, in teenagers, when their soul or the diamond of their character emerges. And often it gets covered over by duty. Some young people, it never emerges. But I think he's interested in that. He's interested in something, them doing something or saying something that's true.
Well, you're making him sound a lot nicer than he is, aside from the parties.
Yeah, I don't think he'd have much care for my ideas.
He gives drugs to kids. He drinks like a fish. We learn that he has shirked almost all of his responsibilities, been a terrible parent. But you say you identify with him.
I think he's a life force. I suppose. I think he's a life force, and yeah, he's not a particularly successful man in the way that in the normal ways of success, which include, you're quite right, his family and relationship. But I think he brings something that's needed for that community. In the end, he talks about the rare blood that he has, but it's an image in my mind of the of a kind. I don't know. It's hard to say. Yeah, I suppose I do feel he gives a certain kind of initiation to the young people, and that initiation does have danger and dark elements to it, but most initiations have that kind of quality.
Do you have to have rose-colored spectacles on when you're playing a character? Always think of the character in a positive light? I mean, if you're playing a villain, do you still, in your head, is he still a nice guy?
I suppose what's useful for me, rather than a judgment of the character, is an understanding of what the character needs, what the character wants. When McEnroe used to go out and play tennis, he didn't go out to give a demonstration of a great tennis match. He went out because he needed to win. He wanted to win each ball. And that's what I feel I need. Judging or presenting a character isn't going to be helpful to me. So I think I tend to talk about things of things that a person, that the character needs or is enjoying. And when I'm on stage with them, I'm wanting certain things from those young people.
Well, the play is set on St. George's Day. He's the patron saint of England, and the curtain that the audience sees as they enter is the flag with the cross of St. George, which was once the flag of medieval England. And when you were talking about Rousseau, I was thinking, does he represent, do you think, or is he intended to represent that old spirit, the fantasy of the energy that England once had that is no longer there?
I doubt that Jez, I know if Jez Butterworth, the author, was here, he would deny that anything represents anything, that he doesn't write that way. But we did talk a lot about the mythology of St. George and the dragon and the maiden. St. George's Day happens to fall on the same day that we assume Shakespeare was born, because he's christened on the 26th of April, so the 23rd has become his birth date and his death date. So it's a mythology that I've always been very curious about. They're both spear shakers. What's the spear? What's the dragon? What's the maiden?
And Shakespeare has been such an important part of your life. You ran the Globe for how long?
That was a good cue. I ran the Globe for 10 years. Yeah, and I suppose I acted Shakespeare from playing Hamlet at 16 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, through to the last shows at the Globe in 2006 for 30 years.
Did you begin your acting career in the United States when you were an exchange student here?
No. My parents emigrated here in 1963. 9/11, 1963. I was called to the little cabin of the boat from my castle where I was playing with knights. It's my earliest memory. And my father says, come here, look out this window. It's a big square or round portal, and out the window is the Statue of Liberty going by. So I landed just over there on the Hudson. But we eventually moved to Wisconsin. My parents were English teachers. And yes, I started acting there in high school and then in the kind of local community.
And then you went back to England on your own, or did the family go back?
No, I went back on my own. I at 17, I started to look for places to train. And I auditioned for RADA first, and they accepted me before I had a chance to audition for American schools.
That was the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Yeah, that's right.
In London.
That's right. So I went back there in 78 and changed the way I spoke and tried to return to my...
So you had to unlearn your American accent, which you then regained when you were in Boeing in the American production.
I did, yeah. I did. I found it... I didn't like standing out so much in England. And I'd lived in Milwaukee with my mother having tea parties on the 4th of July, you know, and being very English. And I thought I was English. But when I got back, I was American. And I still feel very much part American.
Well, you spend, judging from the way your career has been going in recent years, you introduce a play in London and then you come over here and you perform it on Broadway for a while. Then you go back, do another one, come back here. That's
happened
in the last
three
plays.
Two or three years. I haven't done that for very long. Matthew Warchus, the director of Boeing and of La Bête, he says it's much easier as a director to create work in London, that there's less pressure. I think there is a wider, there's not just one critic, there's wider criticism. And I think it's cheaper to work in the theatre. So he finds creating things afresh in New York very, very much more pressured.
Because it just costs so much, and if you have a flop, then you can lose an awful lot of money.
I think it puts a lot of I assume he's meaning the producers feel are much more anxious here.
Well, it's interesting. The director of this play is Ian Rickson, who ran the Royal Court for many years. And the Royal Court, I don't know if it still runs this way, but when I lived in London, they would give I moved sets. It's not exactly... It wasn't exactly a theatrical career. But what I remember is they would give a play a month, an opportunity to establish itself for a month or 2 weeks or whatever it was. And then if the play did well, it would move to the West End. If it didn't do well, okay.
Yeah.
A little bit of money spent, but nothing much.
Yeah.
Still that way?
Yeah.
I wish we had something like that here. The closest we come is the Public Theater, which sometimes launches plays, but it really just functions as a theater on its own most of the time.
Don't things move from the other, from classic stage or from Playwrights Horizons? Don't things move sometimes from these other theaters?
Once in a blue moon.
Huh.
It has to be a huge hit, and somebody has to really feel that it will survive on Broadway after it did well off-Broadway.
Maybe we have some smaller theaters in London in the West End than you have here. Maybe all the theaters are so big that it's a... certainly with Lebet, we had regular audiences of 500, but it's a 1,000-seater theater. So it was a great audience, a 500-person audience, but it wasn't enough to fill that big theater.
Mm-hmm. What about this theater?
Jerusalem's doing having a larger audience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No,
and do you like to work in a big theater? Because it does, it's more physical, isn't it? The smaller the theater, the less projecting you have to do.
I'm a great believer that there's a collective consciousness created in a theater, and the more people, the more imaginative energy that's there. And if we involve the audience properly in our story, then I think everyone's capable of more thoughts the more people there are.
My guest is Mark Rylance, who plays Rooster Byron in Jerusalem, a hit at the Music Box Theater, unfortunately with a limited run, August 21st. For more information, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Only August 21st, because people have other things that they have to go on to?
I don't know why that is. That's just the 20-week contract.
Maybe it will. Would you want it to continue?
I would like to do it a bit more, yeah.
Rooster, you mentioned the story you're telling there. Rooster is quite a storyteller, and his stories often take on an older, more fantastical view of England with fairies and giants.
That's right.
Do you think he's trying to just entertain, or is he trying to stimulate the imaginations of these rather lost kids who hang around with him?
Sometimes I think he's trying to escape from a difficult situation, a difficult part of the conversation. I think other times, yeah, he's trying to bring in some mythology, some imagination that they're... Jez describes the play as a battle between mythos and logos. And I said, what is that? And he said, well, logos, in his understanding, is when you have to eat as a group of people. So you think, we've got to kill that big dangerous animal over there. You go make a noise over there. I'll creep up and hit it with the club. Maybe we'll get it this time. And it takes a lot of logistics. When you eventually do get the animal and you can sit around and eat and you don't need to do that, then mythos comes in. The stories of why there's an animal, why there's light, why there's dark. Mythos is actually much more important than logos for life. But our lives are so dominated now in the media, yourself accepted, by logos, you know, and by this that we all have to be concerned about the economics and all the time, that people are starved for mythos and for something that's more challenging and about the things that are unexplainable.
But isn't Rooster quite different when he doesn't have an audience to entertain with his stories? He loses that mythos.
Well, he turns to it at the end, I'd say. Mm-hmm. He turns to it at the end.
This is a rather large cast also. I don't know whether the economics of putting on a play in London allow for that sort of thing. Includes some great performances, including Mackenzie Crook, who plays Ginger, the young man who is probably closest to your character.
Yeah.
And the one you give the hardest time to.
Yeah. Yeah, he's the one who won't leave the nest, so to speak. Won't. He's living in Rooster's opinion, he's living in a delusion.
Why is Rooster on the verge of being evicted from the land his trailer's on? He's been there for 30 years.
He has been there for 30 years, but what's happening in England, and I suppose it's probably happened in America too, is the development of the develop of housing projects for the city folk. So if a town has a train line through it, then what do you call them, dormitory towns here, don't you, or something like this?
No.
No? I thought that was the name. Well, basically housing estates where people don't really have any connection with the town or the history of the countryside or the land. They just go there, sleep, and then go back to the city and work and believe they live in the country. And they need more space for this, so they're moving him out of the wood.
Yeah, I think we just call them housing developments. Or ticky-tacky.
Ticky-tacky what?
Well, there was a song about those houses that some critic wrote, calling all the ticky-tacky houses. But there are a lot of some very, very nice housing developments in the suburbs.
Yeah.
But he's been moving at, been moved out, and he enjoys annoying his new neighbors because he seems to be the ultimate nonconformist.
He's a nonconformist in the way that nature is nonconforming. Yeah, I mean, you were asking before what's he representing that St. George and the Dragon thing, and I don't know that he's something. I mean, hopefully he's not going to be someone of the past, but he's someone who's very much more connected to natural forces in the land, almost like a kind of rising dragon, kundalini type energy coming through him. He's that kind of person. Well, I hope we won't lose all those people.
Well, he used to be a daredevil in the Evel Knievel vein, and an accident caused him to limp. But he hasn't completely lost that daredevil spirit. At the very beginning of the play, you do a headstand into some water and let us know that this is going to be a very physical performance. And I wonder about it. How physical it is. You're all over the stage. You're limping the whole time, but you're doing things and jumping. And it must be exhausting.
It should be exhausting. I think because he's so defiant, I don't get exhausted.
Even when you're doing two a day?
Well, yeah, even when I'm doing two a day, yeah, I mean, it's a matter of mentally not thinking of any other time than the present time. If I think forward to the whole thing, then it is exhausting. But if I stay in the present, then I don't feel so exhausted.
Do you do any improvising?
Yeah, often we do. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I encourage the other actors to move in different places and play things differently. And we always start with a game of volleyball in the stalls. And that wakes us up to the potential and particularly to the fun of mistakes and bad passes and bad shots. Those are the games that are much more exciting than when everything is done perfectly.
Were there worries about how a play called Jerusalem that's about the English national character would translate to New York audiences?
I think there were worries that people might think it was about the Middle East, yeah.
were there any changes in the dialogue or toning down of accents?
No, I don't. I wouldn't say there has been any toning down of accents.
So this is pretty much the same production with a few changes in actors?
We've cut a little bit, but mostly cut aesthetically rather than financially, you know, for need. And
it's an amazing set.
It's an amazing set.
Same
and
set?
It's amazing it's very much the same play. And the reaction is, I wouldn't say, all that different here than in London.
Well, the play, the run has already been extended by 4 weeks, so obviously New York audiences are getting it in the reviews. I know you've told me in the past that you don't read reviews.
No, I don't.
But trust me, they've been spectacular.
Should I trust you on that?
Yes. Would that upset you to know that?
No, it's nice to know that people write nice things about your course.
Well, you've received awards in both London and already here in New York. You've been nominated for a Tony for this. Since you don't read reviews, do you accept the awards?
I tried not accepting for a little while. I tried making political speeches. I tried lots of different ways to deal with it. I find it difficult, the reduction of things to a competition. But I suppose as I get older now, I see that it's it's really just a way of talking about what's happening and celebrating what's happening. It's a shop window.
Well, I'm going to really upset you now. In a review in the Financial Times of a film called Blitz, Antonia Quirk says that you are our finest actor by a mile and says that she wishes you would do more films.
I bet she doesn't wish I'd do more films like that one.
No, she said this was not a good film. But
oh, it's a terrible film. Don't
but you
go
were
and
fabulous.
See it.
But Mark Rylance is in a fabulous play, and he's great. And it's called Jerusalem. It's at the Music Box Theater through August 21st. For more information about tickets, you can visit our show page at WNYC.org. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks, Lennart.